You're listening to Two Dudes, One Disc, where the most sought-after music journalists, the greatest minds in the history of... You really gonna make me read this
Just read it!
Take on the most influential albums of all time. Here's your host, Michael Heidemann, on Two Dudes, One Disc.
Welcome in, everybody, to another episode of Two Dudes, One Disc. I am so happy to be taking on one of my favorite albums from growing up. This takes me back to the good old days of just being in college. No problems, no worries about the take on the real world. And there's no other person than I would like to take interventions and lullabies on with than the video magnate, the man behind the cam, and the president of the Nate Roost fan club, Mike Pokrifke. What's going on, Mike?
Oh, you know, not a whole lot. Just jamming out to some format. I'm going to push back on you a little bit because, you know, I've told you before, I'm not the biggest fan of the band Fun.
I know. I thought you'd like that intro.
It's hard. Yeah, I know. It's hard to say that, by the way. That's how they get you. You're like, I don't like Fun. And then you immediately seem like a terrible person. But we're talking about the band. But that's how they get you, you know?
It's a little bit different. Well, let's not give that too much away.
Yeah.
We are taking on Interventions and Lullabies, the first album and second release by American rock band The Format, produced and recorded by R. Walt Vincent, and it came out on October 21st, 2003. We're coming up on, 16 years of this album, which it makes me feel so old, but at the same time is so good, because this was a great time for music, and I am constantly reminded of that.
Yeah. I mean, this is an album that definitely, it stands out in that era, in my opinion, because they came from the crop of, like, pop punk, emo, like, all that. That stuff, and then they came out with this kind of like straight pop rock album.
Yeah,
and it doesn't fit with. It's one of these things, are not like the others. But it's just, it's got this production value to it that you wouldn't really associate with a band that's, you know, coming out of nowhere.
Yeah,
but we can get to that in a minute.
No, that's a really good point. Well, let's talk about this first song real quick. It's honestly one of my favorite songs of all time. Like, if I needed to put a list out there, I know I'm gonna get a lot of haters on this, let's say top 10 songs, this song would absolutely make it. I mean, it's just fun, at least one of the best openers to any album.
Oh,
that
yeah,
I've ever heard.
And that's something that, I mean, just listening to this album again to get ready for this, it's so unassuming the way it starts. There's no grand, and it's just the little drum beat followed by the littlest, like, simplest guitar riff.
Yeah,
and it kind of just catches you off guard in a way where you're kind of like, oh, what's happening here, you know? And then,
what are these feelings that I'm feeling inside of my body?
It's like, it's happy but not too happy, and I don't know, it's just it really grabs you. And I think that this song, I mean, if you've heard of The Format, this is probably the song that hooked you.
Absolutely.
Which is funny because it's called it's the first single and the band's called The Format, which they both did both those things to kind of poke fun at the idea of, like, what pop music is. They're following the format of what a band, a pop punk, a pop rock band is. And the first single is this, because this is the single on this album. They thought, like, this is the one that a record company would call the single.
Yeah.
And you know what? It is. It's
you're spot on with that, because it's almost they're the smartest guys in the room who at the same time can play guitar and sing really well. So when I was listening to this for the first time, this was absolutely the first song that somebody showed me. I remember it was at DePaul University with Sarah Walter, and she said, hey, you gotta check out this song. It's called The First Single. It's by this band called The Format. And from the minute I heard those nice acoustic B and E strings being plucked, I was like, this is my band. And then when Nate Roos's voice gets in, I'm like, what is this high-pitched, Muppety kind of voice? And then all of a sudden, you just fall in love with it through the course of this song.
I would say I went to DePaul as well.
Maybe we were in the same room at the same exact time.
I heard of them when I was in high school. A friend of mine, I was in a band, and one of the guys in the band, his sister went to University of Arizona. So she had gotten their EP when it first came out, and this is also the first track on the EP. Ted mailed it to him. So I kind of heard about them pretty early on, in the sense that, you know, he was just like, you got to check out this band, they're called The Format. And yeah, I mean, even the EP, I mean, there's not that big of a difference between the EP and the actual album. A lot of the tracks are the same. The production is very similar. So it is one of those things where they just come out with a sound that is so polished and tight and confident. They're very like, they're confident in what they're doing and what they're making, and everything they do is kind of in service of the song. And it's kind of a no frills sort of a feel to it.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of caught me off because everyone just seemed to be trying so hard at that time.
Yes.
To have a song that just was straight musicianship and that's it. It really kind of, it stood out at the time.
Well, it's funny because I was looking back on some research of 2003 and what albums were coming out. I mean, that was, the Postal Service's Transatlanticism came out that same year.
Wait, Death Cab, you mean?
Oh, Death Cab, Death Cab. See, if anything,
I was going to say if Give Up came up in the same year, that's insane, but that's an insane year.
I'm making a mark to see if I will edit that for all the music snobs out there.
Let's
sing
it again. Let's sing it again. When Transatlanticism from Death Cab Cutie came out in 2003. So now I can't even talk. So
well, now we got to keep it.
You can leave it all in, yeah.
2003 was such a great time for music. Like you said, it was a lot of birth of the emo music, a lot of pop punk music, Yellow Card, Something Corporate, Worthy Bands, Stray Light Run had the, no pun intended, but a serious run going with their albums and the songs that they were putting out. And that first single that we just heard was released on radio on January 27, 2004. And then subsequently, the format went on their big tours supporting Yellow Card and Something Corporate. So it's cool to see where it's going. But you know what? There's nothing to wait about. We got to get to this next song. Wait, wait, wait. See, and then the good thing about this album, it's one of those rare albums, Interventions and Lullabies, that you can listen to all the way through. Yeah, and everything is seamless.
It's really well sequenced, because I think this is actually one of the weaker tracks on the album, in my opinion. Not that it's a bad track. I really like it. But to me, it's kind of this mellow, but it's, you have to do something, you have to change it up after doing something like the first single.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a nice like transitional song to get you into the rest of the album. So it kind of lulls you in. Now, actually, this song, I've never been a big fan of it on this album, but they have released an acoustic version of it on one of their later EPs that I just love.
Yeah.
And it's like just one of those things where just they switched up a little bit in terms of the rhythm, and it really changes the way you hear the song. And I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact, like you were talking about before, Nate's vocals. On the acoustic version, they really shine. Whereas in this one, they're kind of, it's processed. It's buried in the mix a little bit more. But I love this song. Actually, this song was in an episode of Veronica Mars. It caught me off guard because at the time, like the format were not really well known. And I was watching the show and suddenly like she's like in her dorm room and listening to the radio and this comes on.
Was it
might have been Malcolm in the Middle. I don't know. It was on one of those shows. They pop up every now and then.
Actually, both really good shows a part of.
But it's really disarming to hear the format just come on suddenly while watching TV. It's not a band you expect to hear.
It is, because and the other thing about the format is Nate Roos's vocals are so unique that it's like boom, that's a format song. And then it wasn't until Fun came out when I'm like, oh, the format's back together, and it's like, no, this is this new band, Fun, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Nothing makes sense in the world anymore.
Yeah, the one thing I noticed listening to this album, and this song may not be the best example of it, but in terms of Nate's vocals, he's, all the vocals are him on the entire album. He does the harmonies, he does the, you know, multi-tracks.
Yeah. As opposed to the robot that Fun uses.
They
use a neighbor's robot that just comes out of the closet every once in a while, and they go, get back to your job.
But he does it in a way, it doesn't sound multi-tracked. Like his voice, he has a really good range where he sings at a lower register and a higher register without it sounding unnatural. And so you'll hear him switch to be more like a bassy sound and then be more of a treble sound. And it's pretty interesting that he's able to do both and sound good doing both of them, and then also do kind of like falsetto harmonies and stuff.
And his falsetto, it's just so seamless with his normal voice that you almost forget that he's going into a different register or key. You're like, oh, that's just part of this beautiful tone that I'm hearing from this human being.
Yeah, it doesn't break down or anything like that, like when I sing it. It's interesting to actually study from this standpoint, and it's especially when you know where he's headed, when you look at the music of Fun, that's kind of the things that makes the format kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Is that there's a journey here and you can follow it pretty linearly in terms of how their sound develops over the years.
That's right. And we're getting into our next song now, Give It Up, which is...
I love this song.
Oh my gosh. For the third... You know, there's something about the first and third and often seventh song in an album that you're just like, wow. That's like, those are the pinnacle points, because when you're switching around, you usually go one, okay, then to two, and then this for a third song, it, like you said, it kind of sets the bed for the rest of the album. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're not going to get too crazy just yet. There's a lot of good stuff to come, and this is a great way to set that stage.
So I guess another reason why I'm really into the format is I love the Beatles, as basic as that is. And
it's not basic.
Well, it
everyone
is.
Everyone hates on the Beatles
I know.
So much.
Well,
it drives me crazy.
But it's obvious. I mean, yeah.
You know what? I often think, the sidebar on that, and hold that thought for a second, but with the Beatles, it's so interesting because now I love that band so much, and I've tried to go through the conversations with people who don't like the Beatles, but the minute that somebody shits on the Beatles or doesn't like them for whatever reason they choose, or they say that the Rolling Stones collection is better, I kind of lose a teeny bit of respect for that person. I'm like, I don't know if we can hang, because if you can't understand the majesty of the Beatles and what they went through, and surprisingly, did all of that great work before any of them hit 30?
I know. It's crazy.
Just the craziest thing in the entire world.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing about the Beatles, too, is there is a degree of musicianship there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have the reps. They played in clubs every night for years before they became famous.
And played to... just imagine playing to an apathetic crowd as the Beatles. You're playing Yesterday, and people are like, next,
yeah.
It's like, come on.
Well, and that's where... So we talked about Nate Ruiz, but Sam Means is the... So the format's two people. Sam Means is the other half, and he taught himself to play guitar by every night he would pick up the same Beatles songbook and play it front to back. So that's how he learned how to play. So when you listen to this album, you definitely hear kind of a Beatles influence on it. It's a very, like I said, no frills.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything's service to the music, and that's, I mean, for this time, in terms of like that, this scene of music, like emo, pop punk, all that stuff, which I wouldn't categorize the format as those things, but they came from those scenes, sort of.
Absolutely.
But this music, it's very layered and deliberate. And I've heard Sam say that it's almost like his limitations as a musician are a lot of like what crafted their sound. Because there's no ripping guitar solos. There's no... No instrument really dominates any of the mixes or any of the tracks. It all kind of flows in together into this one cohesive, well-thought-out produced piece. Like, even this song, there's, like, slide guitar.
Yeah.
And switches between piano, keyboards, you know. And when you look at the actual album credits, it's like... they have some studio help, and then Sam does everything else, like all the instrumentation, and then Nate does vocals and hand claps. I mean, it works. It totally comes together to form.
Do they really add
tunes.
Hand claps on the album?
Yeah, it's on the album notes. It has Nate does the hand claps. So,
well. You mentioned the band members and who's a part of it. It was Sam Means, Nate Ruiz, Mike Shea, Don Raymond, and Marco Buzzard.
Yes, they came on after the first album to tour with them, and then kind of became like full-time members of the band.
Really?
Yeah, so they were just friends from Arizona, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where all of them are from, but so this first album was almost entirely Sam and Nate. And then the other three, they kind of added as a touring band, and then they all performed on the second album, which is a totally different animal than.
Yeah,
you know, different sound, everything.
It really is, and maybe we should go into another episode where we dive into that.
Yeah, we'll do that one later.
This next song, Tie the Rope. Any info on this
emo
one?
Song.
This is the emo song?
Yeah, it's just the most emo lyrics I think that they've ever put out.
Hanging around. Oh, but it's like the structure of these lyrics and this melody are just so... Every song is so catchy.
Yeah, that's something that I was listening to an interview with Sam, and he points out, and this is what I've always thought about the format, is, I mean, I kind of said before, you know, Nate does vocals and hand claps, and that's it. But Nate, as you see throughout his career, his strength is hearing a melody in his head and bringing it out. And this album, I mean, is nothing if not melodic. Everything's has a great hook. This song is kind of, you know, it's one of those that they juxtapose really depressing emo lyrics with this really upbeat poppy sound. Like just tie the rope. It's pretty hefty stuff, but it sounds so fun.
Hey, you know what? Until we did this podcast, I did not realize that this song was about that suicide.
Yeah,
gasping for air.
Yeah, it's more like murder because he's telling her to kick,
murder,
to kick
suicide.
The chair. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
But it's like talking about, you know, being in a relationship that feels like you're suffocating.
Yeah.
And the other person's suffocating you. So it's like one of those things where it's not just he feels he's suffocating. He feels the other person is hanging him.
Hey, everyone can relate to that, though.
Yeah, I think it's relatable.
Yeah.
Especially when you're like 16, 17, making your way in the world and learning relationships.
That's why this album holds such strength in my own life, because I was right at that time where I was eating up every single emo album that I could, and everything was speaking to me, and every relationship somehow coincided with whatever song I was listening to that week, whether it be Bayside or Alkaline Trio or The Format. I mean, it's very interesting to see how an album can sink its teeth into you during a time in your life.
Yeah, especially at that time of life, you live and die by relationships, and you live and die by music. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, everything about it kind of ties together, and you have such strong emotional attachment to every track. Like, I think this album, I can pick out moments from my life when these songs were playing, or like I was on my way
what
to
were you
this
doing
place.
During Tie the Rope?
Tie the Rope. Well, Tie the Rope was, that song was more, the song came up more often than not because it's so catchy.
Mm-hmm.
This was definitely one of my top, like, singing in the car songs when I was 17. You know, driving around, you know, trying to hit those whoa whoas really up high.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
hard to sing.
Same with this next one here, too. This is the other good car song.
Tune Out by The Format. So what was a young Mike Pokrifke doing when he was listening to... Oh, this is a good song, yes. Mike. This is a good one.
This is the ultimate driving song from The Format.
Talk about a Beatles influence, by the way.
This
You can almost pinpoint the Beatles songs. This is like during a little Revolution, a little bit of those middle album Beatles when they were getting into the drugs.
Oh, yes.
And they were singing a little bit more Beach Boys-y, kind of 1965-ish?
Right. And
yeah.
That's actually, and it's funny you bring up those two things, because I think that The Format is like, they start as the Beatles and morph into the Beach Boys as you listen to them. And that's kind of this song, especially, yeah, the piano with just the acoustic guitar. It's very pared down kind of sound. But again, another catchy hook about being stuck in traffic on the 51 in Arizona.
Yeah. I mean, It's a very Arizona-ish album. In fact, before becoming The Format in February 2002, Means and Ruse, they had become friends back in grade school and had started their first band, Never Gonna Score. Talk about another emo band. Released the EP The Byron Sessions. And we're in this, also in the band this past year, which, you know, got some steam, but then it wasn't until the first single just dominated local Phoenix radio. They grew to sell over 100,000 copies in the U.S. of their first album, and then became like the Phoenix, I guess, like poster boys, to be honest, which I didn't know, again, until we decided to dive into this album.
Now, that I didn't realize most of the story behind The Format until fairly recently, actually. I kind of came in at, you know, later, after they'd kind of gotten their start and kind of blown up nationally almost.
Yeah.
It was like right before they kind of blew up nationally and see them on every tour. But the thing that kind of surprised me about them is, yeah, they were in a band called This Past Year. And actually, Sam said they first met because they were in the Weezer fan club. and met at a show that like somebody was like, oh, you love Weezer? You should meet Nate.
Wow.
And so,
really?
Yeah. So they met at a Weezer concert originally, okay. and they played in a couple bands together. But from what I understand, they weren't like the closest friends. Like they each had friends in the band, but they were like kind of thrown together mm-hmm. sort of thing. I don't know if that's 100% true.
Yeah.
That's how I picked it up from what Sam was saying. But he said that he had booked studio time to do the EP for this and had no plan. Like, he had a band, and then they kind of fell apart and still had the studio time. So his thought was, oh, screw it, I'm just going to go in and record.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he had these tracks written, just the instrumental parts, and, like, the week prior, or, like, you know, 2 weeks prior, just decided he'd kick a demo over to Nate and be like, do you want to record vocals on any of these? And so he said that Nate took the tape and wrote all the stuff, and they came in, and that's how their first EP came to be. And then most of that EP is largely untouched on this album. They just mm-hmm. kind of upped the production value a little bit and mm-hmm. laid down better drum tracks and stuff. But like, that's kind of how they formed. They formed kind of almost accidentally, like by chance. And so that's why it's kind of interesting to see them have such like a polished sound. And you know, become what they became because of the fact that, you know, it just seemed like sort of an accident almost.
Yeah, like they were both really ready to put out an album,
mm-hmm.
and that brings us to our next song. I'm ready. I am.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to ask you because you and I had spoken about this album a little bit beforehand, and I was wondering why didn't Sam Means become the type of artist and reach the level of fame that Nate did? Like, what happened to this Sam, this mysterious character from the format?
Sam. Well, Sam owns a merch company now called Hello Merch that serves a lot of bands. Actually, this record was made by Sam. It's like his company. This is the pressing they did of this album. Sam owns the company that makes these. But they... I mean, there's a couple things that he's never really talked openly about why they split up,
mm-hmm.
to my knowledge, at least. As an outsider, I mean, he has a daughter.
Okay.
And
from early on, did he have this daughter?
She was pretty young when they broke up. I think, you know, probably a toddler or something like that. But like, I'm assuming...
That's an important time in your life.
Yeah, and I'm assuming, you know, as a father myself, I assume it's the whole idea. They were a touring band. They mm-hmm. they were constantly getting on tours and opening for people. And it's like, at some point, you just want to be home with your family.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think when you look at Nate and the trajectory of his career,
mm-hmm.
it's like he was hungry for the spotlight.
Oh,
you listen to him sing. He's theatrical. He's big. He wants it, right? Mm-hmm. And Sam is he's a you know, bring your lunch pail sort of a guy. He sits down, he does the work. You know, again, he lays down these chords, they're on rhythm.
Wrote most of the album.
Yeah.
I mean, give me a break. And they were relentless with their touring. That's what I saw in a lot of my research was the fact that they played every single day.
I think I've seen them probably like 11 times in concert.
You've seen
like
them
that.
11 times?
Probably.
For the format?
Yeah.
So, you know,
I've missed a few key ones in there, but I mean, they were in town a lot, especially Chicago. They came to Chicago a lot.
That's what I would always mm-hmm. hear. And like, the thing was, I was so focused on Blink-182, Weezer, mm-hmm. like we had mentioned, those bands. The format was often overlooked. I wasn't into the smaller shows just yet. I was, but you know, getting to see the format and because I thought they would always be around. I'm like, this is a band that's up and coming. I didn't think they would become this important in my life. What were those first shows like? Like, what was the scene or the energy in the room when they would play?
Again, they came around a lot. Mm-hmm. So I saw them like 11 times, but I still missed like a lot of the first shows mm-hmm. in Chicago. But I will say that it was nice. They were low key, but like upbeat. And so it was kind of like a little bit of a dance party, you know? The shows were never overly crowded. It was like you had your own little space to work with. People just had a good time, hung out, danced around. It was just feel good. It was a lot of fun. They sound great live.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That's the other thing is when you have an album that's basically purely musicianship like this one was, you know, that's what they
easy.
Do live.
Yeah, it's easy, straightforward musicianship. There isn't a lot of pedal usage. There's not mm-hmm. a lot of distortion with your amp, so you're not trying to find a specific sound. This is just,
seventh tracks.
Is this one your favorite? On the
this
porch.
One, yeah, this one's fantastic.
On your porch.
And again, this is... just a guitar.
Yeah.
You know, and just the guitar and vocals. And when you listen to the lyrics of this song, this is, I love this song because it is a very personal song. When you listen to the lyrics, it's about leaving home and moving on to the next stage of your life, but kind of leaving your family behind. And just listen for a second.
Start to close. I turn to you and I let you know that I love you.
Oh,
but it's
sing me to sleep, Nate.
But you have this upbeat pop rock album, and then it kind of grinds to a halt here, and it's almost like, you know, the show is stopping. The curtain's coming down, and you're just hearing this very personal account. Talking about a sick father.
Yeah, yeah.
And what it's like to leave home when there's all this drama happening at home. And you're choosing, again, to go for this career. And you listen to it. It's coming up here a little bit. But there's a great lyric in here where he says, it's time to get out of the desert and into the sun, even if it's alone. And
really, really thoughtful, timeless lyrics.
Right.
You know, this could be easily a pop song, easily a country song.
Yes.
And yet it just fits so well in whatever the format want to go by, folky indie pop.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and again, this is like, it comes off so personal. And you look at the fact that I said before, like, Nate seems so hungry for the spotlight. And this is kind of like his active decision. Like, I'm going to leave home, even though it's hard, and I'm going to make myself into something. And it's an interesting message. But again, this song kind of slows down. It's all in service of this story. And that's one of the reasons that I love the format is they kind of know when to step back. They know when to be big. They know what, and it's one of the reasons why I don't love Fun. But we'll move on.
So Fun does have really, really sad songs. If you can look through all of the heavy production and drum beats and and horn sections.
Well, that's the thing is, Fun, very talented. I mean, Jack Antonoff, you know, you just look up his credits and see what he's done in his career.
Amazing. Amazing performer, amazing singer, a great person who looks at songs differently, Jack Antonoff, and the way that he structures songs. And there's a lot that he can do with a song that might sound one way on an album, totally different live.
Well, and the thing about the format that I think one of the reasons that they interest me more than Fun is Fun seems like a very united front. They're moving in a common direction. The format, I think their sound actually comes from the fact that Sam and Nate's sensibilities are kind of diametrically opposed to each other. So, like I said, Sam is, I'm just here to play some music in the studio and write some songs. And Nate is, I'm going for the spotlight. Nate is theater, Broadway. Nate is, you know, I want to loudly stand on a rooftop and proclaim my love to this girl. And Sam is, I'm going to write her a note and, you know, slip it to her between periods. You know, like, it's
a great
one of those
way to
things.
Look at it.
And so I think that together it kind of like creates this weird, like, nice common ground where Sam's like musical sensibilities and restrictions in some ways kind of box Nate in to like work within this like this arena.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
then they just create these really thoughtful pop songs where, you know, Fun is a bit bigger and the production's through the roof and all that stuff.
And maybe that's why there aren't as many diehard loyal fans to Fun as there are to the format.
Right. Fun plays big in an arena. You know, the format doesn't. That's and it's
Even
just different
Sam
things.
Sam wouldn't be into that. He would
well,
be so
I don't
that.
Know. It's that's the thing. And I mean, that's what I was saying before. Is like, linearly, you look at the way the format's music evolves over time and where Fun ended up. And then Sam's released a couple solo projects himself. Much in the vein of the format in the first single, he has an album called 10 Songs.
What an interesting mind. Like, you know, he gets music.
Right, but he just doesn't care enough to name it, you know? It's crazy.
So you mentioned a little, and that's, by the way, On Your Porch, an amazing song. That's the kind of song you end your mixtape to your girlfriend with.
That's for sure. For sure.
This next one is called Sore Thumb. It's I don't really remember getting this far through the album, like, really ever. I guess I know Career Day I've listened to.
Yeah, Career Day is one of my favorites.
But this is the first time I've really listened to the album all the way through, probably since 2003.
Well, and then this song kind of comes out of, again, sequencing. We just had this, like, mellow, very barren song, and now we're full production mode. Upbeat. This is also another kind of emo one, though, actually. But this one is, again, one of their actually most, like, popular ones, actually. They play it live at almost every show.
Okay.
And, you know, it's one of the standouts, actually, just in the sense that it's, like, one of the bigger songs on this album. I don't know. I've always liked it fine. It's never been, like, one of my favorites, but I always enjoyed hearing it live and all that stuff.
So when you saw the format of 11 times, who'd you go to these shows with? Who was your, format buddy? Who was your Sam? So, who was your Nate?
It was one of those things. So the first couple times I went with my friend who showed me the format, his name was Eric Wagner. I'll give him a shout out.
Shout out, Eric.
He showed me the format. So we went to a couple shows together, and then, you know, I got really into them. And so I'd take other friends. There was another girl that was older that we'd go with who actually knew Nate. So we'd go to a lot of the shows because she was going. So every time they were in town playing places, I would actually hit her up because I figured she was going. So I met Nate one time through her. It was fine.
Well, you got to tell us that story.
Well, no, it's weird because, like, she knows him. And so, like, her thing was like, hey, you got to be cool, man. Like, you know, don't freak out over this.
Did she give you a pep talk before?
Yeah,
she took you to different rooms.
So it was me and the aforementioned Eric.
Okay.
And we're going to the show. And she's like, just be cool. He's a normal guy. And he doesn't, you know, want to do the whole, like, fan thing.
By the way, it's not like we're talking
this
about...
This is pre-show, too.
Freddie Mercury or, like, Axl Rose.
Yeah,
we're talking about Nate Ruz, who's just starting in the format.
And so, like, she's just like, you know, don't fan out on him. Because it was pre-show, too. It wasn't, like, so it was like, you know, we met him briefly, like, for 10 minutes before he came out. Again, yeah, nobody knew who he was. He was just standing in the lobby of the Metro talking to us. But, like, so I'm just going, oh, hey, nice to meet you, man. And then my buddy's like, oh, my God, I heard you guys for the friend. And just, like, totally fans out on him.
Oh, man, he blew
it. So he totally blew it. And so, like, he kind of, like, was like, cool, great, good to hear, and kind of excused himself. And I was like, well, that was the worst possible outcome for this.
What was your fan, your friend, like, that was the coolest thing,
I don't
thing,
know.
Man.
No, I think he knew we blew it. He had to have. It was bad. It was really awkward.
Was it bad? Was there a time when Nate was, like, looking away doing that? Like
it was kind of like I'm sure it was like one of those things. Where, like, why should you bring these guys? You know, and like I was like trying really hard to like downplay things. Like I was like, whatever, you know, like trying to be cool. And so it probably just led to this really weird exchange.
I'd like to think of you all like with like the format T-shirt sign at this.
Yeah, actually, I think he did sign a shirt for me before he left, and then my mom washed it. So. It kind of came right out.
Jeez.
So it happens.
Yeah.
I remember not being that upset about it for some reason, even though they were like my favorite band at the time.
You know what? That's funny you say that because now, do you remember when autographs were the thing?
I know, yeah.
The thing. And now when I get my shirts written on, because like I had a time where I bought a T-shirt and the guy that I wanted to see, and he signed it. And I was a big fan of this guy, but like all I could think about was, dude, come on, now I'm not gonna be able to wear this.
I know.
Like, it has a big scribble on it.
I know, that's the one thing is it's like you're like, oh great, he signed my shirt, and then you're like, I can't wear it, can't wash it, can't. So like I
washed it. I was just like, screw it.
At some point, you're just like, I'm just gonna wear the shirt.
Autograph.
It's worth. It cost me $30.
T-shirts are so expensive now. They're so expensive.
Yeah.
But you probably met Nate before the time of the selfie.
Yes, yeah, it was definitely my. I mean, that's why I have no record of like any of their concerts because you know cell phone photos were garbage.
They were all garbage.
Yeah,
they were always blurry.
And Legos.
Do you remember like winding your camera and click?
Yep.
And all of them turned bad, and then you'd get them back from the from Walgreens or something, and two would be usable.
Yeah, two would be decent. Yeah.
And they still look like the kind of like pictures you'd like a serial killer would put up on his wall. You're like, ugh.
My favorite thing about that is the fact that like it was so policed too at concerts. Like you have a disposable camera and you're gonna take a photo of like the stage from the back of the United Center, and the security guard like comes over and swats the camera out of your hand. Like you got a good photo of anything.
It's like, it's, you can see anything, and it's all like washed out. It's like, and also the lighting would always be terrible, and it would just be, I remember, just big blurry spots. Mm-hmm. It would just be like where the lights
or
would
the
just explode.
The flash goes off, so it's just the back of the head of the person in front of you brightly lit, and then just like darkness. You know,
I remember those. I have so many of those from like all the shows that I went to, and you'd like try to sneak at you. I remember like
it's all blurry.
You move really fast. Oh, geez. But now it's like, that was such a good time for music, and never did I think about one day I'd be able to, like, everyone would have their phones up here.
Yeah, it would take 4K video.
It would take 4K video.
With a decent microphone.
But you know what? It's funny because now going to a show, I mean, growing up, you and I are the same, or like similar ages. Yeah. I think we are the same age.
Yeah.
But when we were going to shows, everyone was just, the crowd and the people would actually talk to each other.
I know.
And then you'd make friends at shows. I haven't made a friend in a show in years.
I know. You'd see,
I don't know, well, if it's me. Maybe it's just me, though.
The
maybe
other thing me. Is that I think a lot has to do with the fact that, like, the, like, I don't know. It's hard to explain in the sense that, like, back then it felt like, because there were so many more of these bands, mm-hmm. and they were all constantly touring simultaneously, you'd mm-hmm. go to a show and see the same person at three
right?
shows in a month.
Yes.
And then so you'd kind of be like, oh, hey, I saw you at this other show, and you'd kind of strike up a conversation. Mm-hmm. And because right away, there's like three bands that you both like.
Obviously, you guys would get mm-hmm. along. You'd have something to talk about.
Right.
I remember those days.
That's actually, and now this next talk
I was going to put it on pause, right. because we just walked through a Mess to Be Made, which is another great Beatlesque, beautiful
it's
pop song.
Banjo.
Yeah, no, banjo. Great breakdown, cool bridge.
What's was that? It's not quite an accordion.
It's not quite an accordion.
But no, it's, I mean, that's another song that it's
like a harpsichord.
Very folksy.
Yes, yes.
And that was something that the format kind of unlocked in me too, mm-hmm. Was this kind of more of appreciation of that, like, little southern twang folk sort of song.
You didn't think you'd be into it until you see a band do it right.
Because you just think like bluegrass, you know, and it's like one of those things I was largely ignorant of mm-hmm. at the time. And mm-hmm. so to hear a band kind of incorporate these sounds mm-hmm. To, you know, what they're doing, and then it kind of like was like, maybe I should give some of the, who are their influences? Maybe I should give this a shot. Maybe I should check out, you know.
Yeah. Well, I looked into their influences, and one of their great influences was one of my favorite bands, which is Electric Light Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Lynne. I think they're actually coming back to Chicago fairly soon. And that is, you can see a lot of that weird, again, it's Beatlesque, but like kind of from the future, I guess you could say, and a little Beach Boys involved too. But behind all of it is just great, solid musicianship, amazing guitar-fronted rock, which is just, you know, an amazing influence, really, for Matt. I could see it.
That was something that actually Sam touched on a while ago. They talking about the way the format kind of develops over time. Sam felt, when they started, that he was the better musician. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the sound is like controlled and carefully curated, like he's a guitar led. It's him taking the helm and doing these things, and Nate's just writing melodies over them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that so much of their musical journey and their writing journey together was him like relinquishing control to Nate.
Mm.
And not in like a bitter way, but like in a way where it's like, oh, hey, Nate has these opinions, and now he's coming in and saying, hey, I want you to make a sound that sounds like this, and not, you know, me handing him a track and saying, I want you to put melody over this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it is, you know, it sounds that way. It's very music first. It is. This is the guitar track, and we're going to build around it. But they do take the time to consider how they build around it and what sounds are going to weave in and out. And mm-hmm. I think one of the cool things is all their songs, while not feeling super dynamic, there's like a change to them sonically as they progress. There's a narrative there where instruments kind of could dip into the mix and then come out, and you know, it builds in a lot of ways.
Yeah. The writing process for an album, and I'm a musician myself. I play around here in the city, but I've never put out an album. And because half of the reason is because all my songs are shit, number one. But number two, I'm just joking. Some of them are okay. Number two, though, is the amount of work that goes into that album and that production piece, and then working with people, not only in your band, but your producer, your mm-hmm. engineer, and getting all these things just right. And I think that I'd be so OCD and so perfectionist that it would take me at least 17 and a half years to get like the first half of the album done.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing about recording music, and especially these days, now that it's so accessible, like mm-hmm. you can get like a home setup that's decent enough to make something.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you can just do it forever then.
Yes.
And at least yeah. like what they were dealing with, like I said, it's like he had booked 2 days or 3 days in his studio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, we just got to get in and get this done. And so it's like, it's some, you got to give yourself deadlines.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where that's one of the things that music moving out of the recording studio has kind of changed, where bands seem like they're endlessly writing. And actually, Sam himself is one of those people now that he released an album and it takes him years to get up the, you know, work ethic to do another one, because he's mm-hmm. doing all this other stuff on the side. So he has these songs just sitting there, and it's just a question of getting in the studio and recording it. But instead, it's like, I got to do this thing first. Yeah. I got to do this
first. Sam, if you are listening, and I know you're a big fan of Two Dudes, One Disc, you need to put out these songs already. We've been waiting long enough. We miss you, man. Come on.
Check out 10 songs. It's a couple years old now, but it's very good.
You know, let's dive into this next song. I wanted to keep talking about what we're talking about, though.
And this song,
Let's Make This Moment a Crime.
This was on their original EP as well.
Okay.
It sounds largely the same.
We just gotta take our time. It's like nothing.
I love how clean the vocals.
Jeez. You know, it's like, it's like his notes and how he hits everything so perfectly. It's like he never stops singing. Like his voice is the like sixth instrument in the song.
Right. And that's actually something that you know, again, vocals and hand claps.
Mm-hmm. Vocals and hand claps.
He is an instrument. And I think his voice is very emotive. It's not whiny. It's mm-hmm. whiny-ish.
It's a little whiny.
It's like one of those things where it's a pleasant whiny. Yeah, he's not whining at you.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, I was re-listening to a lot of old, and I know I'm going to get a lot of hate on this too, but I'm going to just come out and say it. I was listening to Guns N' Roses the other day, and some old Guns N' Roses, and Axl Rose, it sounds like he's whining at me now. I think I'm over, like, there's months when I'm like, yeah, this is rock and roll, but there's sometimes when I'm like, God, man, how did this band get so famous? If it wasn't for the Slash's, like, seriously insane guitar solos,
mm-hmm.
that guy's voice is just, you know, you gotta do a right kind of balance, and he does a right kind of balance, Nate.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's, again, it's at the time, everything was whiny.
that's true.
So
that's a really good point.
It was one of those things where this
the
was
birth of Screamo was happening.
Yeah, I know. That's the crazy thing. It's.
Do you have any favorite Screamo bands?
Favorite, that's a hard one. Because I listened to a lot of it, but again, it doesn't last. Like,
true.
It was one of those fads.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I guess if you would qualify Brand New as Screamo.
Oh, okay, Brand New.
They
yeah,
do Scream, but
that.
It's not like this, it's not central to their music, but they do Scream.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably my favorite of that era, like Taking Back Sunday.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Which they're kind of, again, less on the screamy end of the Screamo movement. There's a lot.
Taking Back Sunday is one of the most surprisingly awesome bands that I've seen in the last 15 years.
Really? See,
listening to their albums, I wasn't that much on board. Seeing them live, I was like, I'm in 100%.
Oh, I saw them live early, and they were so bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
they were, like,
so I'm
really
glad they turned that around. It was one of those things. They were one of those bands that you'd see, and you're just like, why am I here? You know? They were really, like early Fall Out Boy live was terrible.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know
mm-hmm.
if you went to any of their early shows.
Late Fall Out Boy is actually not much different.
Really?
Like, but, you know, there was a time when Fall Out Boy was, like, my go-to band for years and years, and seeing them at the Met, I mean, there's something about the energy that even if they would have screwed up and they just like would have played all the wrong songs and all the wrong notes, it was just the time for
yeah,
music.
To yeah, it was a good show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they didn't sound
it's
great.
A good show.
Yeah, it was. Whereas the format sounded great live. And actually, you know, you talked about like seeing them live. One of the things that was interesting about the format is they wouldn't often like tour with the same bands.
Mm-hmm.
I saw them with Motion City Soundtrack.
Mm.
I saw them with. They did a tour with like All American Rejects and Something Corporate towards the end there. That's one of the shows I missed because I wasn't going to pay that much money to see a band I'd seen a bunch of times. but one of the bands they played with pretty frequently was Anathalo.
Oh, yes, yes.
They're from Michigan, and but they were kind of, they were an interesting sound for sure. They were way more mellow and like meditative music. But that's notable because the third member of Fun is from Manathalo. The one, I forget his name.
Andrew Dost.
Andrew Dost, yes. That's it. Yeah, he was from Manathalo, and I discovered Manathalo through the format, and they were amazing live.
Oh my
so
gosh, you can imagine.
I got all their albums and like really got into them, mm-hmm. and like so it's like the format and Manathalo. I'd go see Manathalo at Shuba's. I, you know, like it's one of those things. It's like those are my bands, and then Fun killed both of them. No, that's not how it happened.
The Fun died and made everything die. Well, this is Career Day. Yeah. We were both mentioning that we're both fans of the song. This is still into this
probably
day.
My favorite format song. And actually, interestingly enough, of all the time, they've only played the song live once when I've seen them.
Really?
Maybe twice.
Okay.
Maybe I'm misremembering. The other show that I really like stands out to me in memory in terms of the format, because mm-hmm. They played with Manathalo at the Metro. That was one of the ones that really stood out, because they kind of shared the stage and both played the whole night, and it was a ton of fun.
That's so cool.
They did another show in the suburbs here where Dr. Manhattan opened for them.
Dude, I bet you and I went to so many of the same shows. We probably bumped each other a million times.
Dr. Manhattan, they were friends of friends. Like, my friends...
There was a time in the Chicago music scene where everyone knew
everyone knew each other. Like 504 Plan, Dr. Manhattan, Knockout, Plan. Like all those guys.
Oh, Knockout. Yeah. Come on, man. They're actually... is Knockout still around? How about Punchline? Do you remember Punchline?
I remember Punchline. I think you told me recently that Knockout's still around.
Oh, yeah, they're coming back. And then, like them and then...
Plain White Tees.
Plain White Tees, Flowers for Dorian, I remember, was coming up a little bit. They would tour with Dr. Manhattan a lot. I saw Dr. Manhattan at my local roller rink on more than one occasion.
All right, yeah. I wonder if I was at that show. Because I would, again, Dr. Manhattan was like friends of friends. Mm-hmm.
But they were like from the up same and area. Coming.
Yeah, and they were probably the band that got the biggest outside of Fall Out Boy. Mm-hmm. They were like the one that like was like the, they were on the trajectory, you know, and it just didn't quite, the scene kind of died for them.
Truly.
But they opened, I remember they opened for the format, but it was, I forget who the band was. I was trying to find it the other night. Mm-hmm. There was a bigger band that was playing as well.
Like from Chicago?
No. They were like a nationally known band.
Okay.
But at the show, they switched the lineup around. Mm-hmm. So this band opened, and then Dr. Manhattan played next, and then the format played next, because they're playing like 30 minutes from Dr. Manhattan's hometown.
Yeah.
And so you could tell this band was so salty that they had to open for Dr. Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And so they were like on stage openly like kind of complaining and scoffing about it, but not, I don't think they realized that like everybody there was there for Dr. Manhattan and the format.
Right.
So it was like one of those things where they were super, super salty about it. But I remember that because everyone was kind of like, yeah, finish up your set. Everyone wants
you know
to see
what?
The real
I bet
show.
It was, I bet it was the hush sound.
Oh, those jerks.
They're actually the nice guys.
But that show
nice girls
was
too.
One of the shows where the format played this song. So this is, but and this, I love this whole.
Another pick of the banjo.
Yeah, more banjo.
Great. A piece of artwork this album is.
Night driving song.
Oh, this is...
Yeah.
And then, of course, this great chorus right here.
Yeah, where it just kind of like rings out
pseudo
over
chorus.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorites, because this is probably the one that I have like the strongest memories tied to, just coming home from friends' houses. And mm-hmm. You'd always be like, you'd listen to the front half of the album driving to wherever you were hanging out that day, mm-hmm. and then on the way home, you get back in the car, and this is where it picks up, and so you're kind of reflecting on your day and what you did and all that stuff, and this is kind of ringing out pleasantly in the background. So
where'd you grow up, Mike?
So I'm from like Zurich. Originally.
You know, this is so weird mm-hmm. that you say that, because I remember, I like was having a flashback as you were just speaking, mm-hmm. Of driving back and smelling the grass and seeing the dead like lawns in Lake Zurich, coming back from Grays Lake Zurich, and back home, because this was a perfect just suburb when there's nothing to do and nothing to see, I mean, ride home kind of song.
And also, I mean, the other thing about it is because, like, I'll take credit for this a little bit. This wasn't all me, but in terms of like my high school, like the first single. Like, I'd play that, like, play it, you know, my friends and I in a band would play it, like, at shows or stuff like that. And so the format kind of became a thing in our school, and, like, so everybody knew who they were.
Most people
did. And, like, at least had some appreciation for some of their songs. So it's one of those things where it was not uncommon to get in someone's car and kind of catch this track coming on and stuff like that. So,
those are some good times.
Yeah, so this song really takes me back. It's probably the one that's strongest tied to memory for me. And also, I love the lyrics. Mm-hmm. I love everything about it. It's just it's one of the songs that actually feels more grown up on the album too. Just the Today's Been a Career Day, Futures Made and Fortunes Lost.
It's so true, because this is a song that I think like the Arcade Fire could be like, you know what, I think we're gonna cover Career Day for like one song.
Right,
like,
yeah,
a band that's established.
It feels like a little bit more like a step up in maturity, mm-hmm. almost in the way that On Your Porch does.
Yeah.
You know, it's introspective. It's it just like it scratches at something deeper,
yeah.
which is something that I found like as I got older, I yearn for in music, you know,
something deeper.
Like, yeah.
Well, Mike, we're already at the last song, a save situation.
Yes,
this has been incredible. I want to keep and we will keep talking, but I don't think I've ever heard this song before.
Well, yeah, this is this song actually. I had to laugh because I while like. We talked a little bit how there's not a whole lot about this album on the internet, and I was doing some Googling and found like an old review of it.
Yeah,
and the reviewer loved this song, hated Career Day.
Oh,
loved it. But this song is, in my opinion, their most forgettable song, and it's the last on the album. It just seems like they kind of dropped it down here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like this song. It's my least favorite format song, probably easily. So it feels very tacked on to this album.
It was mixed by R. Walt Vincent, the producer of the album, and Chris Fudgrich.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry.
I don't like it. Yeah, this is the one song from them that I just like. To me, Career Day ended the album.
It did.
It's one of those things
that's
where...
That's such a great closer to the album. Like, this would be... This is a great song that you put, like, at minute 14 of Career Day.
Or,
like, the secret song.
Well, right. I was just going to say, this feels like a secret song.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the way Career Day kind of rings out, because, like, the Career Day repeats itself, like, 8 times or something like that at the end.
Yeah,
so it feels repetitive, and you lose track of time when listening to it. It's one of the reasons why I love... You'd be driving around, and you'd forget you're still listening to Career Day, and you'd kind of... drift in and out of it, and so it always felt like this song always felt like a secret song, because Career Day kind of like takes you out of the album nice and slow, and then this song kind of builds in from silence, and there's like highway sounds and stuff, but it's a short little track, and again, like, it always just kind of felt like it wasn't actually part of the album.
Yeah,
so I never really appreciated it. I should probably give it a fairer shake, to be honest, but I don't know, it never really grabbed me. But the rest of the album I've listened to over and over again. This is like I'll get to the song and just be like, yeah, let's just go back to the beginning or switch to the next album or something. So
truly one of the best albums of 2003, if not ever. And Mike, this has been a total pleasure. I have so much more to talk to you about. We need to come back and do Dog Problems.
I love Dog Problems.
It's an amazing album. With Dog Problems, their next album that came out in 2006, I actually quit a job because of one of their songs on that album.
Oh, really? Which
yes.
one?
It was the song, and tell me if I'm right. I hope it's not a fun song, but I believe it is on Dog Problems. It's the Lottery.
Oh, no, that's a fun song.
Oh, no, not The Lottery.
The Compromise?
No, maybe it's called Life is a Gamble.
Oh, this is actually something I was telling you about the other day. That is a fun song as well, but it's a song that on Fun's first album, I told you, like, I gave Fun a shot.
Yes.
And I listened to it, and there were, like, maybe 3 songs that I was like, all right, I do really like these songs, you know, but I don't love the rest of it. It's not grabbing me, you know, sort of a thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, then the next album, I liked less songs and stuff like that. And a couple of years ago, I follow Sam and Nate on Instagram, and Sam posted an Instagram story that was like an old notebook he found.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a photo of the potential track listing for the format's third album.
Mm-hmm.
And the three songs that I like on the Fun album are in the track listing for the Format's third album. So I was like, well, of course that's why I like them, because they're more Format songs than Fun songs.
Oh, man. Yeah, mine was, it was At Least I'm Not As Sad As I Used To Be.
Oh, that's on Dog Problems, right? No, that's on Fun.
That's
the first,
Ignite.
Aim at Ignite, yeah.
Great song.
I know, yeah.
They're not all bad.
Well, and the funny thing about the Format is, they have so many songs about record labels and like the being in a band, and it's really funny because they didn't do much. They recorded two albums.
That was it.
EPs.
They were in and out. 2003 to like 2008, maybe. Like Dog Problems came out in 2006, and then they were kind of I guess dropped from their album. Like it says, nobody knows really what happened.
They got dropped by their label right before Dog Problems came out. Like they'd finished, they recorded a lot of it, and the label heard it and hated it and dropped them. The producer of that album called them up and was basically like, hey, I'm willing to finish it if you are. You know, we just got to find some money and some time. And so they got together and decided to release it themselves. And then to make matters worse, this is at the time when like leaking music was like the big thing.
And that album
got leaked before it was formally released. So they put all this time and money into it themselves and somehow it got leaked. And so they ended up just like putting it up for digital download and purchase. The next
36,000 people downloaded the album at that time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and now at that time, they talked a lot about the way the music industry was laid out. It was the label would get a huge cut of every album sale. And so 36,000 isn't a whole lot, but it was 36,000 people that they were getting the lion's share of the purchase for. So they said that it became a much more viable career for them once they kind of took things into their own hands and kind of, you know, took control.
Yeah.
So,
on February 4th, 2008 is when they disbanded as a band with a single message on the band's website.
I know. I remember opening up that post in my parents' basement. I was home from college and on my laptop. And the weird thing about it was I remember I was sitting at like a table that I never sit at. Like I had like a laptop.
Oh, something was up.
And it was like
something was afoot.
It was just something like I just happened to set up my laptop in a spot I don't normally do. Mm-hmm. And then I got this like alert that there was a new post on there and I opened it up and it's, you know,
no way.
They're not a band anymore. And this is actually
you never sat in that spot again.
This is off the heels of their last tour, which was an incredible show. They played the Vic for that tour. And like they, Ruben's Accomplice, Steel Train opened for them.
Wow! So was Jack in Steel Train?
Yes, Jack's in Steel Train, and so they opened for the Format, and the show was amazing. Like they went all out, and it was so fun. And I just remembered like leaving that show, being like, "It's gonna be like this forever. like it's gonna be the most fun show. Like this is the best band to see live. Like all this stuff." And little did I know that they were like going all out because they knew it was probably the last time they were touring together.
Oh man!
You know, so it was one of those things where, you know, for me it was like, "Oh man, they're only getting better and better. This is never gonna stop."
Like they say in The Outsiders, "Nothing gold can stay, Ponyboy."
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Mike, I asked three questions when we end the episodes of Two Dudes, One Disc. Are you ready to take them on?
Yes, of course.
Okay, they're actually really not that hard, so don't worry about it. So I need to know, out of the Format's very small discography, what is your go-to karaoke song by them?
Oh, that's hard. I would say, I mean, I'll go with the first single. Mainly because that was the song that I would play live with like my friends if we like were playing shows or for practicing. It's also the song that whenever I pick up a guitar, I warm up with the opening riff of it. It's
like, and then this, often like you see people like if people like perk up and they're like, oh yeah,
yeah,
like,
yeah. It's like, usually someone's like,
me.
Yeah,
you get
I'm like,
me.
I'll spare you the rest, but you know, it's like the way you move your fingers when you play the opening riff feels good. And so like I sing it a lot, I hum it a lot. If I were to sing something in karaoke, it'd probably be that one.
All right, right on. You already answered the second one, which is, have you ever met the person or what was your experience with them? But I wanted to know, what was going through your mind? Like, were you really happy when you were meeting Nate for the first time? Have you ever met Sam?
Oh, it was, I'll say this. I, like, especially at that time, I hadn't met a lot of musicians mm-hmm. or anything like that. So it was like this otherworldly experience, right? Like, oh man, I mean,
how old were you?
I would say 16.
Okay.
That would probably be about right, 16 or 17.
16 is the like geekiest you can
yeah,
be.
Yeah, I know. People. Because, you're like just kind of like getting your license and mm-hmm. out in the world a little bit. And,
I'm a man.
And like, it was like probably one of the first five times I like went to a show without like Whoa. Somebody, like my older brother who yeah. was 6 years older than me or something like that. Like, it was like the first time like I drove like with friends to mm-hmm. Chicago. Not the first time, but like one of the first like three or four times mm-hmm. that like drove to Chicago alone with friends. Mm-hmm. And like it also was a cool experience because that kind of became like the blueprint. Like I started going to a lot more shows because like we had so fun and it went so well.
Yeah.
That like it kind of opened up this world of like, we're going to go every weekend, you know, and who's at the Fireside Bowl?
It's going to stay like this forever.
Yeah. It's going to be like this forever. Yeah. Yeah. Ask me the last time I went to a show. I met Sam. So, like, I told you before, like, I was trying to play it cool for mm-hmm. Nate. Like, it wasn't whatever. It's not a big deal, you know. It's sort of a thing. And then at a different show, at the end of the show, I had my ticket stub, and I had Sam sign it. He was up on stage, and just, like, they ended. And again, he's just standing there, taking apart his own pedal board on yeah. stage after they finished.
So
sort of
humble,
thing.
Sam.
And so, like, you know, there's a few people hanging around chatting with him, and I'm like, hey, you know. You said, can you sign this? We're like, for being like, yeah, whatever. I'm not impressed by Nate. Like mm-hmm. trying to play it cool. Like mm-hmm. meeting Sam for me was like, oh, here you go, Sam. Like is the cool.
Because,
again, he played all the music. He was the guy that
he's the mind behind the majesty.
And I've always kind of like gravitated towards the silent. Because I'm not, I've always gravitated towards like the silent, like stern creative type.
Yes,
like it's like,
yes.
I respect that person because they only express themselves mm-hmm. in their art, you know? And yeah. so for him, like meeting
Stoic.
Him was like, whoa, what is that? So I met him like one time. Mm-hmm. Nate, I probably bumped into like twice, but.
Hey, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, so that was about it.
And you had to see them at the height of their fame too, which is
yeah.
really cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, it was kind of cool to, I mean, again, we talked about Fall Out Boy. Like, those are the two bands that, like, you know, I got to see kind of go from almost nothing to a big thing.
Bigger than
you
life.
Know, to randomly coming across their songs in public to then, you know, Fall Out Boy, you hear in arenas now. And you hear fun. I mean, you hear fun in arenas, too. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, one of those things where it is interesting. Like, you know, you hear people talk about fun and you hear their songs places. And it's, like, one of those things where I'm like, hey, I met that guy when he was... you know, a scraggly guy with dirty long hair, you know, basically living in a van, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, met him at the Metro and really freaked him out and love it, you know. So.
And then they're asking for your autograph. They're like, because yeah. you met him one time.
Oh, sure.
I love it. I love hearing these kind of stories because these are some of the bands that I grew up with. Finally, you're a little bit older now.
Mm-hmm.
You have a little wisdom underneath your belt, and you're cool as a cucumber when it comes to mm-hmm. meeting these celebrities. So if you can meet Sam and Nate, what question would you ask them?
Oh, man. That's hard. I mean, again, I said before that like I really identified with Sam mm-hmm. when I was a fan. And now like I have kids, and mm-hmm. Sam has a kid. And his priorities have totally shifted mm-hmm. in a way, like this seismic shift towards family and building a life and sustaining yourself mm-hmm. in a way that my life has shifted. I don't do music anymore. I have no aspirations of being a touring musician, stuff like that. Whereas Nate went so far the other direction. He's now a nationally known big name in the music world, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like one of those things where like I almost feel like I have nothing to say to Nate in the sense that it's like...
He does have a kid now.
Oh, really?
He does have a little daughter. I did look that up.
I had no idea. See, I haven't kept up with him at all because of it.
Yeah, he has a little daughter that is named something. Oh, here it is. He started dating English fashion designer Charlotte Ronson.
Okay.
And they welcomed their first child, a son named Levin Ronson Rouse.
Oh,
and then
cool.
their second child, a daughter named Olympia Rouse.
I mean, 19. So yeah, being a boring adult now, I'd probably ask them something about parenthood and like having kids. And, you know, I've always wondered what it's like for these bands that, you know, you have a kid and, you know, sometimes you're out on the road for 6 months or, you know, 5 months with mm-hmm. you know, only, I mean, now at least there's like FaceTime and stuff, but like you're still not there for them.
Yeah.
And you're still leaving behind like a partner who's doing all the work mm-hmm. while you're out on the road. And sure, you're earning money and stuff like that. But, you know, at some point it's an interesting dynamic and mm-hmm. that I'm kind of fascinated by it because again, having a kid shifts all of your priorities around. Mm-hmm. And it mm-hmm. certainly seems like that's what happened with the format. Again, I'm guessing at this, but it's like, Sam had a kid and suddenly it's like, well, I don't want to tour 9 months a year anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to, now Sam stays home for the most part and records an album every now and then mm-hmm. Near his house, you know, which actually one thing that is kind of cool is he has a video that his daughter directed. Like it's like,
really?
She shot it on like a home video camera and they made a video in their yard for one of his songs. It's The Other Side of You. So it's worth checking out, but it's like, it's fun. Like he has his little partner in crime, you know? And so it's like interesting to see that kind of shift from like the music to his family sort of a thing. And so I'd probably ask, you know, questions about, you know, how did your life change when you had a kid, mm-hmm. you know, and basically, you know, it's pretty obvious for Sam how it changed, but mm-hmm. and so I guess I'd probably ask it to Nate now because he's still now in this position of fame.
He hasn't done anything for a few years.
Yeah.
So maybe
he had a solo. He did a solo song.
He did do the solo.
It wasn't
song.
As successful as fun.
And that one song with Pink.
He did that. He's everywhere, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I like that. So you'd ask him to babysit. You'd be like, hey, yeah. Sam, I'm really busy.
Yeah, I'm really, really busy, Sam. Like, I'm gonna go on tour.
I gotta live my. You lived your dream, Sam. Yeah. I'm gonna live mine now for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mike, this is so much fun. Hey, can we find more information on you?
On me? I mean, I never plug myself. I don't go on podcasts very often. So
this is your time.
You can find me
man.
On Twitter. It's at Kryfke, KRYFKE. Mm-hmm. I'm on Instagram too, but that's private, so don't bother. but otherwise, you can find some of my work at MikePoPost.com. I don't know. Oh, also, I used to do videos with friends under the name Gorilla House. Gorilla House Films or Gorilla House Productions.
The Gorilla House?
Gorilla House. Well, yeah, we're the Gorilla House. but actually, it's worth checking out because a buddy of mine, we kind of pivoted from films to my friend publishes novels.
Wow.
Under the title of Gorilla House now. So that's the publication company we do. So that's worth checking out. He writes good stuff. I'm not mm-hmm. taking credit for his thing, but it's probably more worth your time than anything I'm up to. So.
Is he the Sam and you're the Nate, or are you the Nate and he's the Sam?
I would say, no, he's more of the Sam. There's Jack McGuigan. He has a book called Dog Walker, mm-hmm. set in Chicago.
Wow.
So that's worth checking out, but it's weird. I don't know how to describe it. It's like a sci-fi horror sort of a thing.
Cool.
But,
I'll check it out.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not really a plug for me. Sorry.
Yeah, I give you this time to talk to millions of listeners.
You know, I should say, just check out WGN Radio and look at the videos that I make every day.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, Mike, you do an awesome job making all the videos for WGN.
Thank you.
And if you want to see any of our great, great hits and the potential award-winning videos that Mike puts on, WGNRadio.com. Mike, I can't wait to talk about dog problems with you.
Yeah, we'll get set up.
All right, thanks for joining us on this episode of Two Dudes, One Disc.
Thanks for having me.
We'll just go out on a little first single. See you next week.